I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. There's this idea out there that religion and science don't interact, but for Brother Guy, it's an everyday occurrence. Today, a conversation with the director of the Vatican Observatory. We'll find out what the recent discovery of seven Earth-like planets means for the Catholic Church, and if aliens are real, would it be okay to baptize them? But first, a look at the fashion industry in town, just as Kansas City Fashion Week kicks off. We'll find out what has designers, photographers, and models from all over the world working together in the heart of the Power and Light District. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. KC Fashion Week is here, featuring professionals from across the fashion industry. They're working with designers and stylists, makeup artists, models, and photographers to present their collections in the most professional atmosphere imaginable in premier runway shows. Kansas City is also home to a new, a few months old nonprofit. It's called the KC Fashion Council. Look out, Paris. Who knew that Kansas City was a hotbed of fashion? With us today, Tisha Barber is president of KC Fashion Week. Tisha, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Annette Pinter is executive director of the KC Fashion Council. Annette, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Now, Tisha, there are a few people listening, probably just a few to this, who are going to be stunned that the words fashion and Kansas City can be said in the same breath. What do you have to say to them?
I have to say that we've been doing this since 2012, so something's going right
in Kansas City. Yeah. Annette, what do you say to them?
I say that we've been so successful in these last few years of bringing people from all over the region to Kansas City to celebrate the designers that we have, and everyone should come out and support this week in our city.
But we're still a blue jeans and casual shirt kind of town, aren't we? I mean, isn't that what we are?
I think it depends. Everyone has their own sense of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is, everyone is getting up and making decisions every day as to what they're going to wear. And it's fashion is a big part of our economy.
Mm-hmm.
and revitalizing the arts in our city.
And that history goes back a ways in this town, but still, Tisha, the notion that there are designers here in town, again, that's going to surprise some people.
It does definitely surprise people. We have so many local Kansas City designers that people aren't aware of.
Hmm.
And every season we have so many that apply that are even new to us that we haven't met before. So it's always great to see every season.
Why are they picking Kansas City as a base of operations?
A lot of them are local, grew up here in Kansas City and want to stay in Kansas City and don't want to move to the larger cities.
Mm-hmm. Is this a crossroads district, a centric kind of activity, or are they scattered all over the metro?
They're scattered all over the metro. We have several from Kansas, Overland Park, Leawood, Shawnee, and then we have several from the Missouri side as well, Blue Springs, Independence, Raytown.
Okay. Annette, what is KC Fashion Week? What are we talking about here?
It is really just people from all aspects of the industry coming together and supporting our local designers and the design industry as a whole. We have people that come from Iowa, from Texas, Oklahoma. We've had over the last several seasons some Project Runway designers that come to Kansas City. The feedback we've received from Project Runway designers is the quality of the production that happens here in Kansas City is not found in a lot of other cities in their fashion weeks.
What does that mean, the quality of the production?
From just how well organized and how everything is really done for the designers so that they can really focus on just their design.
Is that your job to make this sort of a seamless kind of activity here?
It's the job of the entire planning committee.
Mm-hmm.
We work a lot of months ahead of this week to ensure that it is very organized and and focused on the designers.
So Tisha, then what happens here during the week? What activities are going to take place?
Well, we actually started the week yesterday. So it started on Sunday and then we go all the way through next Saturday evening. So we start with a few pre-events, which we have usually some fundraising, which we did a fundraising event for the Kansas City Fashion Council yesterday. And then tonight we have a media night where we bring in a lot of our media attendees that will be attending the shows. And we have a special designer preview for them tonight.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow we have our kickoff party. It's a cocktail party. And then we start the runway shows on Wednesday.
And so should I be hurt that I haven't been asked to model this week? Because I usually get an invitation every year, but I haven't seen it this year. It could be ageism at work here, Tisha. I'm telling you.
No. We don't have that, definitely.
You don't have that. Well, how successful can somebody be here who's Kansas City-based, who works very full-time in the fashion industry? What are we seeing?
I think that they can be. It's very important for our community to be cognizant when they're out shopping that they are supporting our local retailers and our local designers that have their clothes in our local retailers. And
how would somebody know if a Kansas City designer, the piece of clothing they're looking at is designed by someone here in town?
That's a good question.
Maybe that needs to change.
Well, yeah, it does. It definitely does. And then that's a responsibility of some of our retail stores also, letting mm-hmm. people know that they're mm-hmm. a local designer. I do see that changing. I see a lot of the local retailers and boutiques wanting to change that in Kansas City. And then we also have some of our designers that are opening their own stores.
Yeah.
Specifically, Natalia Meyer, she owns a custom tailoring store in the West Plaza area called Lucia Sarto, and she's one of our success stories where she's shown at Kansas City Fashion Week several times, and then she opened her own location.
Yeah, I was going to say, put a name on a face to all this. Is there a designer or two that you guys might highlight, and can you describe the kind of fashion they're putting forth?
I think that we have one of the most successful or professional tailored menswear designers here in Kansas City. His name is Christian Michael. And he is getting ready to debut his first women's wear line, which is very exciting for this fashion season.
What distinguishes his menswear?
It's the quality of the tailoring is really impeccable. It's something that you would see in Paris or Milan, just very, very well made and all handmade couture menswear.
Where can you get it?
And he has at Halls. And, you know, it's one of those two where you contact him personally and he will make you what it is that you're looking for.
How about a woman's designer that you might highlight?
I would say Tomboy, Laura McGrew. She has been in several boutiques around town, and she's been pretty successful in the KC industry.
Where are these boutiques?
The one that she's specifically in is out at
Prairie Fire.
Prairie Fire.
Oh, sure.
In Overland Park, Leawood area.
So how do people connect with these boutiques and these designers? I mean, is there a website to go to, or how can people navigate this world more successfully?
I think that's one of the things that the Kansas City Fashion Council is definitely going to try to help with, is making sure that the public knows where they can contact all these designers and all of these different retail outlets, because that is an issue, is people just don't know where they can go to see the local Kansas City designers.
But no question, we have local designers who are working full-time in the industry based here in Kansas City.
Absolutely.
How big of a step forward is that? How new of a development is that?
I would say it's been in the last 5 years. I feel like there was a big increase in the support of our arts when the Kauffman Center opened and the funding that came into Kansas City and just the backing of our local artists. Because fashion is an art.
Well, that's interesting. You look at it that way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so the changing culture, the emphasis on the arts has opened up the doors for designers here as well. That's exciting.
It is.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. Back in January, the Kansas City Fashion Council was founded to help bring people from all corners of the fashion industry together here. Annette, give us more of a sense of what are the day-to-day tasks of what your organization is all about.
Well, it's really just coming off of these few weeks out of the year of Fashion Week, that our goal is to continue that sense of community and place for people from all aspects of the industry to have a resource throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've been doing some things, most recently, some service projects. Everybody wants to help the community in some way, but maybe they don't know exactly how to go about doing that on their own. And as a fashion community, just, you know, with the tornadoes that were in Kansas City just a couple of weeks ago, we were able to do a very successful clothing drive where people also came together and donated money. And it was our, you know, fashion models and photographers and designers that all came together and donated these things for our community. We did the same thing with having everyone bring 1 yard of fabric to an event that we were having. And that 1 yard of fabric amounted to 100 yards of fabric that we were able to donate to a local school in our urban core in art classroom.
That's great. Tisha, I'm curious, how did you guys get started in fashion here in Kansas City? What's your story?
My story is I actually started as a model. Gosh, I don't even know how many years ago, but I also did event planning. So I had a passion for both, and I my full-time job is as an interior designer. So I started working with Phil Willoughby, who's Kansas City Fashion Week CEO.
Yeah.
And he asked me to come on as the executive director back in 2011 for Fashion Week because he had just started the idea of trying to do this twice a year. So
you must have great taste.
I hope so. Think that I do.
Annette, what's your story?
My story is one of I grew up here in Kansas City, but I wanted to go to New York and I wanted to experience Fashion Week there. And so I went out and worked in the fashion industry in New York for about 7 years. And then I moved back here to Kansas City. And
why'd you come back?
I was excited to be back. Kansas City has a lot going for it. You know, there's a lot of people that see us as a flyover state, but it's really an amazing city and community. And I was excited to come back. And with the knowledge of working, I worked New York Fashion Week producing for several seasons. And so I was excited to come back. I met Tisha and got involved with Kansas City Fashion Week.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about KC Fashion Week. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Does this town, Tisha, have trendsetters? Does such a thing exist in Kansas City?
It definitely
People
does.
People you look to who are on the cutting edge?
It does. We have an extensive amount of fashion bloggers here in Kansas City that people probably aren't aware of, but every season we have about 50 media attendees that are mainly fashion bloggers that talk about all of the different fashion that comes to Kansas City.
50
fashion
bloggers
Week.
Here in town talking about fashion.
Yeah,
here.
And we some of those do come in from other regional cities, but for the most part, they're all local.
Yeah. What are the latest trends that the two of you are noticing around our town when it comes to women's fashion? Is there anything that's sort of jumping out at you right now?
I think streetwear, which has been coming on the scene in other cities for a while.
Streetwear meaning?
Meaning kind of your own take of maybe men wearing shorter pants and, you know, that no sock long sweater look for men.
It seems like everything these days is tight, tight, tight.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Well, I think that it depends on the occasion, but we do also for women still seeing a lot of that athleisure look, you know, that's kind of the take on the nicer look of than just wearing yoga pants out, but comfort. And I think that we see that through the history of costume and fashion over the years, that kind of the way that our economy is right now, you see that go into the looks and fashion that we see on the streets.
What's the biggest change in women's fashion that the two of you have seen in the last 5 or 7 years? I'm having thoughtful gazes here towards the heavens, searching for an answer.
I would say, especially here in Kansas City, people going to more galas and events of really dressing up has become a thing again.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful.
Yeah, it can be great. Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 as we talk about KC Fashion Week. Angela from Overland Park. Angela, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm enjoying listening to your program, and I probably tuned in the middle of it, and perhaps you've already mentioned it. However, I don't know if the names of Baldwin or Byron are two of our biggest designers, I think, that originated in Kansas City have been mentioned at all.
Tisha's nodding her head.
I wanted to throw those names out because I'm not sure that that those names were mentioned.
Yes, they are. They are two very great designers here in Kansas City.
And what are they known for, Angela? What's your sense?
My sense, I know Baldwin is known for their jeans, and of course, you know, they do a lot of upper-end casual dressy wear, and they're sell all over to United States and a lot of big department stores, big-name department stores. I know the Byron line is just men's, and they, men, you know, do their, the designers do their own suits out of Kansas City, and they sell to many other specialty men's stores within the United States also. So both of those two names are, I think, some of the bigger designers in Kansas City.
Okay. I appreciate that, Angela. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
How about men's hats? You see that more and more. Or is that still new, or has it sort of been around for a while?
I think it's been around for a few years now. We definitely do see a lot more accessories for men, mm-hmm. not only hats, but handbags as well.
Handbags?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. We actually have a local handbag designer, Dolan Bags, who's providing some handbags for Christian Michael that I mentioned earlier for his runway line this season.
You know, people think of fashion, and tell me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them might think about big bucks to keep up with the latest. Am I right about that?
Not always. I think that it's important that people buy quality, and quality is sometimes going to be more expensive. But if you buy quality classic pieces, you're going to have them forever, mm-hmm. and you're going to find those by not always in a department store. That's going to be a local made, nicely tailored piece.
Mm-hmm. People might also think it's a little pretentious, all this focus on fashion, a little snobby, to suggest that some people are in style and some people maybe aren't.
I don't think anyone is not in style. Everyone has their own style.
That's
the big thing that people need to take away from that, is everyone has their own style, and that's how people express themselves.
Does it take guts to be in style? Because it suggests that people who are in style are wearing the latest fashions, and the latest fashions can, you know, can sometimes be something new and a little bit different.
I think that it's important to just dress for you and what makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, again, that it has to be what is perceived to be in style, and that's the exciting part of Kansas City Fashion Week, is that people really come out to support from all over the city and region, and they bring their own style.
But if you're going to try something new and different, like mm-hmm. there had to be some man who carried the first handbag, and that's different. That takes a little bit of chutzpah, doesn't it?
It does, because, I mean, especially here in the Midwest, people will look at him walking down the street and be like,
What's up?
Be from somewhere else, because people don't do that here.
Right.
But
right.
It does take a little bit of guts, but I think we're on the right track of people actually branching out and doing things like that.
Tisha, do you have guts? I mean, do you look at yourself as someone who will sort of swallow hard sometimes and venture out into the great beyond doing something a little bit different?
Yeah, I usually try to, especially during Kansas City Fashion Week. That's We try to support some of our local designers and wear some of their clothing during the week.
So, like, what are you doing this week?
We
I mean, what have you done personally this week? What are you wearing that might?
We're actually doing Friday night is our night that the entire committee is wearing all white.
Oh, really?
Yes. So yeah. We've all selected dresses that are all white. And then Saturday evening.
And why all white? What's the point?
Last season, we did all red one night.
Oh, really?
And so everyone on the committee was dressed in something completely different, but everything was red.
Yeah.
And it's just a nice way for all of us to look similar, but also be different with our own styles.
So you've had 1 year of white, 1 year of red. So next year will be
blue. We'll see.
It's got to be blue, red, white, and blue, right? Yeah.
Well, and what your listeners can't see is that Tisha is also 8 months pregnant right now.
So it's a little bit more difficult for me this season.
I was going to say that's tricky.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's been a challenge, but we'll make it work.
How accepting in that is Kansas City when it comes to the new and different?
I think Kansas City is probably one of the most accepting cities. That's what makes us great, mm-hmm. is that we have people from all over, really all over the world that live here. And, with all of the different industry that is here, we're seeing a lot more tech companies that are opening up here, and that's bringing a more diverse community.
Mm-hmm.
And that, again, is just helping to support our arts community.
Well, if the two of you had to point to one event this week that you might recommend to our listeners out there, what would you point to? Is there something that you would say, hey, this is a great place to interact with KC Design Week, Fashion Week?
Yeah. Tomorrow night is our Bubbly and Bow Ties event. So it's a black tie cocktail event that is taking place at R24 Studios in the West Bottoms, which again is a fun place. That the West Bottoms is kind of going through this revitalization, and it's a fun place to hang out. And so I would encourage people, you can still get tickets now at KansasCityFashionWeek.com. And again, it's just a great evening to have guys pull out their tux jackets and bow ties, and it's just really a great evening.
And away you go. Well, listen, I wish you both all the best of luck this week. Good luck, and good luck with your pregnancy. And
thank you.
Hope it all works out this week. That's Tisha Barber. She's president of KC Fashion Week, and Annette Pinter, who's executive director of the KC Fashion Council. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the heavens and what they might mean for you. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, the film critics previewed the upcoming KC Film Fest and discussed the latest films showing on area screens. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow we learn why earthquakes are becoming more common and what it means for the Midwest. Also, bridging the partisan divide in a time when loyalty to one's party seems to come before loyalty to the country. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the notion that there might be life on other planets got a boost recently when a NASA telescope discovered the largest batch to date of Earth-sized planets around a star called TRAPPIST-1. Yes, the star is far, far away from the Earth, 40 light years away, in fact, and some doubt whether life exists on these planets at all. Nonetheless, the discovery has people talking, and one thing they're talking about is this idea that of what if an alien shows up one day, what then? And there's this question, too, for the theologians among us. If aliens did show up, would you baptize them? Thank goodness there are people out there who think about these big, sweeping questions, and one of them joins us now. Brother Guy Consolmagno is a Jesuit planetary scientist for the Vatican Observatory, based at the Pope's summer residence in Italy. He won the Carl Sagan Award from the American Astronomical Society for his writing and speaking. He's taught at Harvard and MIT and is co-author of Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial and Other Questions from the Astronomer's Inbox at the Vatican Observatory. He joins us now from WBUR in Boston. And Brother Guy, nice to have you. Good morning.
It's great to be here.
You were once asked if you would baptize an extraterrestrial, and you said, only if she asks. So let me try this one more time, Brother Guy. Would you baptize a being from the great beyond?
Again, we all know what baptism is. We never even think about it. By asking the question, would you baptize an extraterrestrial? What you're really asking is, what does baptism mean? Why do we have it? What are the functions? And does that really apply to another creature? And the answer, of course, to all of those is, who knows? We don't know. I don't know if there are beings out there. I don't know if we would be able to communicate with them. Certainly, you don't want to baptize somebody if they're not able to know what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's a great what-if question. It's a great science fiction question because it forces you to take the stuff that you thought you understood and realize maybe you don't know it as well as you thought.
Well, we're joking about this only a little bit here because theologians like yourself have actually given questions like this some thought. Do I have that right?
To be honest, not a whole lot of thought, precisely because we don't have the data. I wind up getting asked it all the time, partly because I'm an astronomer at the Vatican, partly because I am a science fiction fan. You know, the last time I was in Kansas City was for the World Science Fiction Convention.
Hmm.
And in both cases, you know, in every case that I've found, people always come back to the same principles that we don't know, and it's always dangerous to hypothesize before the data comes in. And yet, it's a marvelous what-if question because it asks you, what does baptism mean?
I'm wondering how controversial this issue is because there's something called Canon 864 of the Code of Canon Law that restricts baptism to human beings. So, again, we're going deep here, but how big of an issue would that be?
Well, of course, what you're really talking about are people who are in a position to know that they exist, to have self-knowledge, to have the freedom to know and choose to love or not love. Those are the aspects of the human soul. What the canon's talking about is that you don't baptize dogs and cats. And certainly that's what they were thinking of when they wrote the law. Obviously, I also agree with that. So, you know, if an alien came, the first question you have to ask is this, you know, just, you know, a dog that was stuffed in a spaceship by the alien someplace else, or is this the alien themselves? You know, we wouldn't even know that at first.
You know, as someone who spends a lot of time gazing into the heavens, can you imagine this in any way taking place in your lifetime, this notion that aliens might make it to Earth?
I can imagine it, but I don't really expect it. The distances involved are such that with our physics today, we can't understand an easy way that it could happen. And yet, if you asked the same question 1,000 years ago, people would, you know, scratch their head and wonder what you were talking about because of physics they had then. Couldn't even understand what the question meant. Ask me again in 1,000 years and maybe I'll come up with a totally different answer. Hmm. Science is fun that way.
Yeah. You know, NASA, again, as I mentioned in the opening, has discovered this whole batch of these new Earth-sized planets out in the great distance there. Is there life out there somewhere, do you think, Brother Guy?
People ask me, you know, do I believe in extraterrestrial life? And that's the right question. It's a matter of belief because I don't have the data. And yet I would say that I believe that the possibility is real enough that it's worth my time to look for it. I believe that there are planets around other stars enough to say I'll go looking for them. And yet all of this search is in some ways colored by my own expectations, by my own, you know, provinciality. For instance, twice you've talked about NASA discovering these planets. In fact, the planets were discovered by a telescope in Chile run by a bunch of Belgians. Hmm. And NASA put out the press release that some of their satellites participated in characterizing these bodies. You know, it was an international thing. And yet we in America, we see it from the point of view of NASA found, and as people, we would say, oh, it's exciting, we found a place where there might be life. Where in fact, most of the planetary scientists I talk to go, there's a small M-type star out there with 8 planets or 7 planets. That's remarkable. How do you physically make that many planets in stable orbits? Hmm. The questions you ask are colored by who you are and what your background is. That's what it is to be human.
Brother Guy Consolmagno is my guest. He joins us from WGBH. I misspoke a few minutes ago. It's WGBH out in Boston. He'll be in town Wednesday to talk about why science needs faith at the Linda Hall Library, co-sponsored by Rockhurst University. Registration is currently closed, but you can join the waiting list by emailing events@lindahall.org, or you can live stream the event. We'll have the information on our webpage later on today. Well, the Pope was once asked about this notion of baptizing extraterrestrials. How did he answer his own question, Brother Guy?
It was an interesting point because he was trying to make the point, again, just what I've said, how we always view things from the expectations we have in the universe we live, the bubble we live in. And he was making the point that to the people in ancient Palestine who were the first Christians, they were all Jewish. And the idea that Gentiles might want to join the church was as weird and as alien to them as the idea that, you know, there could be Martians who wanted to join our church would feel to us today. The beautiful thing about astronomy and religion both is that they pull you out of the bubble you live in. They pull you out of the day-to-day. You go outside, you look at the stars, and you suddenly realize the universe is bigger than, heaven forbid, even the Final Four. You wonder about who I am and what it means to be alive in this universe. Both astronomy and religion do that to you.
If our listeners have questions for Brother Guy, the number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. How similar are these planets to Mother Earth here, the ones that were discovered not that long ago? Give me a sense of that.
Well, the star is a whole lot smaller than our star. The star is physically not that much bigger than Jupiter, maybe 10, 15 times bigger. And that means that the planets have to be close to it to be in a region where water could be liquid. What we can tell from the planets is that they blip the light of the star a little bit, so that gives us a sense of how small they are. They're probably about the size of Earth or Venus. And they pull on the planet. You can see the planet wiggling by the way its light gets shifted back and forth, which tells you the mass of the planet. You put the size and the mass together. It's like a present at Christmas time. You know which ones have socks in them and which ones have candy, by which is denser, which is lighter. These are not planets full of socks. These are planets that could be full of candy. They're dense enough to be rocky. Beyond that, we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And that's the exciting thing, because now we've got a place where we can actually study more carefully bodies. 40 light years sounds like a lot, but it's actually relatively close in terms of, you know, astronomy. Close enough that in the next 20 or 30 years, we might have telescopes that can actually identify spectra in atmospheres. Is there water there? We don't know yet. Is there oxygen there? Free oxygen? We don't know yet. All of these things are exciting things that the next generation of space scientists will get to find out.
Yeah, I'm wondering, maybe a wild question here, what the thinking is inside the scientific community. If planets far beyond us do contain life, would that life come in the form of human beings, or could it be something very, very different?
We don't know.
Just don't know, yeah.
We don't know, but here's what we're guessing. We think we understand a bit of the chemistry of how life works, and the chemistry is really beautiful, really complicated chemistry that involves always carbon in chains, carbon that can make single bonds or double bonds and store energy this way. This is how we know every bit of life on Earth works. So that's our first guess. Probably it's based on carbon. Okay, we know that life that's based on carbon has these certain chemical reactions, so you'll look for traces of those chemical reactions. But, you know, in the long run, 100 years, 1,000 years from now, the one thing that would be surprising to me is if we're not surprised. So that's why you do know of certain things you keep looking for, but you always keep an eye out in the corner of your eye for something to surprise you. It could be anything. We've only got one example of a planet with life, planet Earth. Mm-hmm. We don't even really know how to define life, and I don't think we will know until we have more than one example.
Yeah. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Michael from Waldo. Michael, you're on Up to Date with Brother Guy. Good morning.
Yes, I read a science fiction book some time ago by one of the Star Trek writers. I think it was James Blish. I think the name of it was A Question of Conscience. But it was about a priest, a Catholic priest, who encountered an alien. I don't remember the circumstances, but they had quite a dialogue in it. I wondered if you, if you've heard of that.
Famous book.
It is.
Brother Guy, you say the title of the book is Peace of Conscience.
No, A Case of Conscience.
A Case of Conscience.
Okay, yeah. It's a long time since I read it, but it was very good.
Yeah. it came out in the 50s. It's a marvelous book, and it raises lots of interesting issues. Now, of course, you can nitpick. You always nitpick the things you know. The priest in question was a Jesuit. Well, the things he says actually aren't typically
like
the way
the
Jesuits actually, kind of like the Pope, or me. And we know that the kinds of questions he asked aren't the questions that Jesuits would ask. The reactions he has aren't the reactions. And yet it's a, you know, it's a great page-turner. The theology that he spouts isn't actually Catholic theology, but it's the kind of theology that James Blish could imagine in the future, somebody might say. So, you know, it's valid as science fiction. What is plenty of other books that do that. There is a more recent one called The Sparrow, again, having Jesuits finding life in other places. I always blame the Jesuits on this.
The thing, though, Jesuits that I hope... quite more advanced than the rest of the hierarchy of the church as far as scientific and...
Well, of course, that's a tempting thing to ask me as a Jesuit. But I'll point out in counterexample, the Big Bang Theory, invented in the 1920s by a fellow named Georges Lemaître. Georges Lemaître was a Catholic priest and actually also a phenomenally good mathematician, and he was not a Jesuit. He was a diocesan priest, just like, you know, the fellow at your local parish. But everybody always called him a Jesuit, and he said, no, it is possible to be a diocesan priest and be smart. You know, you don't have to be a Jesuit.
Yeah. Going back to science fiction, it was science fiction that drew someone like yourself, Brother Guy, into the world that you now occupy, right? The writing and the rich trove of ideas out there?
Absolutely. It made me realize that the universe is a big and exciting place, and life is... Everybody's life is their own fantasy story. We get to write our own novels. I heard that there was a wonderful science fiction collection at MIT. That's why I decided to be a student there. And I studied planets because, to me, planets were places where people have adventures. I still feel that way.
Back to some phone calls here. Logan from Lawrence. Logan, you're on Up to Date.
Thank you for having me. I want to ask, just because hard science and religion are so often butting heads, that I want to ask if the implications of this discovery, do they overturn anything that so much of what theologians posit? I mean, does it present challenges to people who would otherwise say that this can't possibly be true because of our religion?
Anyone who says that it can't be true because of their religion hasn't been paying attention to their religion. You know, if your faith
is afraid of science... Yeah.
Well, if your faith is afraid of science, you don't have any faith. That's the first step. But in reality, both science and religion are not big books of facts. You know, there's the science facts and the religion facts and what happens if they contradict. Because neither of them are about facts. They're about the conversation as we try to understand the facts. And we can have the same facts that, you know, the motions of the planets that they had at the time of the ancient Greeks, and we understand them in a different way now because we understand gravity differently. We understand how science works differently, and it's not stopping. Ask me again in 100 years, and we'll have a deeper understanding.
And maybe this is why you've often said that the perceived conflict between religion and science is way, way overblown.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think there's a conflict, look at me. I've got an MIT degree, and I'm a Jesuit brother. Try to explain why there are so many scientists who are deeply religious people or so many scientists who are deeply spiritual people. The fact is, it's hard not to be spiritual when you're looking at the world, when you're looking at the universe and realizing just what a rich and beautiful and mysteriously wonderful place it is. That is a religious awe. It's what gets me up in the morning to do the science.
Logan, thanks for the good call. Let's go to Pamela from Westwood. Pamela, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Father Guy. I am wondering if our faith and our prayers always reference heaven and earth and the people on our planet. If there are aliens, beings on other planets or systems, do you think God would have domain over those entities also? Or would it just be heaven and earth?
It's a wonderful thing that, you know, in our language, we by accident use the same word for the sky, heavens, and in other languages, it really is literally cielo, the same word, heaven and also sky. simply because I think both of them give us that same sense of awe, and people would project, well, maybe up there is where God. We, of course, know God is not part of nature. God is supernatural. God is outside of space and time, created space and time, and then in the incarnation entered and became a part of space and time. So God listens to everybody's prayers. That I'm convinced of. And that includes any entities. I don't care how many tentacles they have. I don't care what, you know, they're having for breakfast. God loves the universe. And any part of the universe that's capable of loving God back is the reason, to my mind, why God created the universe. So did he create it just for me? He certainly created it for me, but also for you. I'm not too sure about this fellow who's doing the interview, but I presume him too. And you know, whatever planet he comes from. This is the whole point of having a God that is bigger than the universe, bigger than any particular place or any particular time, a supernatural God.
I'm wondering if you have regular contact with the Pope when he visits during the summer months.
The current Pope doesn't visit during the summer months. He's decided that the days of taking the summer off in this modern world, that's just not going to fly anymore. And in fact, even when Benedict was in the Papal Palace and before him Pope John Paul, they were working all the time, so it became really less practical to go out to Casta Gandolfo. So where we have our telescopes, it's now a museum. People can go in and see where the popes used to live. They can go into the gardens and see those beautiful areas. We work in a corner of the gardens now away from the Papal Museum, which used to be the Papal summer home. Back in the days of JP2, you'd see him out the window.
I was
going
to say, you used to see him all the time. Yeah, I've read that. Yeah.
But we don't actually rub shoulders that often. It had happened, but it wouldn't happen that often. We do tend to, you know, have groups from the observatory chat or have an audience with the Pope. We have a summer school every 2 years, and we bring in 25 students in astronomy from around the world. And all of the popes have made time to meet with them, talk to them about their astronomy. But it's not something that happens every day or every week.
So what is the Vatican Observatory? I think a lot of people will be surprised that the Vatican has one.
Mostly it exists to remind people, to surprise people, if you will, that the Church loves science. Science is a way of getting to know creation in a very intimate way. And that's how you get to know the Creator in a very intimate way. If any mom knows that you put up the drawing of your kid on the you know, refrigerator door because you love that drawing because it reminds you of the kid you love. Well, this universe, the stars in the sky, that's God's drawing. That's God's art. That's God's way of expressing himself to us. And it's not just me saying that. You can find that, you know, in Paul's letter to the Romans. Since the beginning of time, God reveals himself in the things he's created. So to my mind, doing science, being open to the way the universe really is, not the way that I think it ought to be, and being always humble enough to say that I never have the final answer of how it really is, that's how I get closer to God. It's an act of worship.
Hey, how did the Vatican come to amass such an amazing collection of meteorites?
Oh, like everything there, it was a wonderful accident, a divine coincidence, if you might say. There was a meteorite collector in the 19th century who was a Frenchman, the Marquis de Moan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. My French isn't great. And he collected meteorites the good old-fashioned way. He bought them, and he had a massive collection. And in the end of the 19th century, he said, the Vatican's got a wonderful museum of art. Why doesn't it also have a museum of natural history? The trouble was, in those days, the Vatican didn't have room for it. But eventually, they made an agreement with the national government of the Vatican City-State, made an agreement with the government of Italy that they recognized each other, and then the Pope's summer home was given back to the Popes. At that point, that was room enough to set up what eventually turned into our meteorite collection. Since then, we've added to it through donations, through trades. We've now got maybe the 20th largest collection in the world. I wouldn't say the largest, but you know, the Smithsonian is bigger. But it's a lovely collection of basically one piece of every kind of meteorite that's out there. And that means we can do wonderful survey work to find the kind of physical properties as they go across all the different classes.
You once said that we went to the moon too soon. I'm wondering, what did you mean by that?
You never want to say too soon, and yet we went to the moon before we were ready technologically to take advantage of it. the moon is a marvelous place. I want to go back. If I had any dream in my life, it would be to have a colony on the moon that I could visit. I think it's far more attractive a place than Mars. It's much easier to get to. It's much closer to get to. The gravity's lower, so you can do fun things like, fill up a collapsed crater tube, seal it off, fill it with air, and then you could build yourself wings and fly. I'd always want to do that. Hmm. You could also do really exciting science there, both the geology of it. The moon, we don't understand. The moon is a fascinating place. We said with the Apollo program is going to be the key to understanding the Earth, and it has been, and it's taken us 50 years, and we're only beginning to scratch the surface.
But the moon is just a big rock, brother guy. Why does it hold so much?
Oh, but it's a fantastic rock. And when you study the trace elements, when you study the physical structure, when you notice things that we've always noticed and never really understood, why is the front side of the moon different from the back side of the moon? It really is. We don't have a good explanation. But it's also just a wonderful place where people can have adventures. And it doesn't take a whole lot more technology than we've got now. Elon Musk is talking about running ships up there in 20 or 30 years. I think it's possible. No reason why we couldn't.
Maybe a good way to end. A caller from Boston wanted to ask this question. In these troubling times, Brother Guy, and as a scientist, where's the proof of God's love?
There is no proof. You can't prove it any more than you can prove your spouse's love or your parents' love or your kids' love. You have to start the world. You have to start each day. Do I assume that there is love in the world? And once I assume that the world is filled with love, then I see the world in a way that this can be confirmed or, sadly, in some cases, denied. But you start with the assumption. Every logical system has to start with an axiom. And for me, the love of God, and that the idea that God created a good universe, is not something I come to at the end of the day. It's the assumption that allows me to see through this filter of God's love, through this lens of God's love, to see the beauty of the universe.
Brother Guy Consolmagno will address Why Science Needs Faith Wednesday evening at 7. He'll continue how he just answered that question at the Linda Hall Library, an event co-sponsored by Rockhurst University. No seats are left, but go to our webpage for information on the waiting list or live streaming of the presentation. Brother Guy, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
It's been a delight. I look forward to getting to Kansas City.
You bet. Thanks very much. Tomorrow, why earthquakes are becoming more common in the Midwest and bridging the partisan divide in politics. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.